That mines Iran lodges an official protest over the U.S.'s seizure of its oil near Greece, saying it's deeply concerned about Washington's continued violation of international laws. China hits back at U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who called for action to counterbalance Beijing's influence. And Russian forces have come closer to surrounding Ukrainian troops into eastern cities as they try to expand control over the Donbass region. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran has summoned the chargé d'affaires of Switzerland that represents U.S. interests in Tehran to protest the seizure of an Iranian flagship in Greek waters. The Iranian Foreign Ministry expressed strong protest at the U.S.'s clear violation of international regulations on free navigation. The ministry urged the immediate lifting of the confiscation of the ship and its cargo. On Wednesday, it also summoned the Greek chargé d'affaires in Tehran to protest the confiscation of the vessel. Greece impounded the Russian-operated vessel this week following a U.S. request. Iran says the ship was carrying oil and sought refuge along Greece's coast after experiencing technical problems and bad weather conditions. Iran says the U.S. has unloaded the cargo, and that amounts to international piracy. Historian and political analyst Markus Papadopoulos says Washington uses Greece as a tool to deepen its influence in the eastern Mediterranean Sea.
Greece is used as a tool by Washington to not only enhance America's position in the eastern Mediterranean and also in North Africa, but also to try and interfere in Russian foreign policy objectives in the eastern Mediterranean, Syrian foreign policy objectives in the eastern Mediterranean, and also Iranian foreign policy objectives in the eastern Mediterranean. And it comes as no surprise to me whatsoever that the Greek government, which is only independent in theory, has acted on the instructions of Washington by detaining this Iranian vessel. Why? It is a way of the Americans attempting to interfere with Iranian trade as a way of trying to weaken the Iranian economy. Greece, as I said, is fundamental to America's position in the eastern Mediterranean.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says some countries in the region and beyond are sending Takfiri terrorists to Afghanistan. Ali Shamkhani said terrorism and radicalism are among main causes of insecurity in Afghanistan. He pointed the finger at the United States, saying Washington and its expansionist policies are at fault for the 20-year war in Afghanistan. Shamkhani said the U.S. must release Afghanistan's frozen funds and make up for the financial damage it has inflicted on the country. The top Iranian security official was speaking in Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, at a regional summit in Afghanistan. On Afghanistan, that is, Shamkhani said his country has always backed the security and stability of its neighbor. He said Iran is hosting around 5 million Afghans without effective international aid. The fate of the 2015 Iran deal remains far from clear as talks between Tehran and the P4+1 group are stalled. As we'll see in this next report, Iran says the main remaining issue in the talks is about its right to economic and trade benefits under the JCPOA.
Talks to revive the 2015 Iran deal, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, remain stalled after a year of intensive diplomacy. Senior diplomats from Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held many rounds of talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The diplomatic initiative to restore the deal has become a long and complex saga. Whether negotiators will finally cross the finishing line is anyone's guess. All parties have acknowledged that there are a few remaining gaps that need to be bridged between Washington and Tehran before the deal emerges. But what's keeping the talks from further progress? It has been repeatedly said that Washington's refusal to remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from its terrorism blacklist is the most important sticking point. But Iran's top diplomat has given a vastly different account of what is blocking the path of the negotiations. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian told the World Economic Forum on Thursday that the issue of the IRGC being on the U.S. blacklist of terrorist groups is a minor issue that has been exaggerated and magnified by the Israeli lobby, and that Iran's top priority is the interests of the nation. He also warned that American interests and foreign policy have been taken hostage by the Israeli regime. Israel has made no secret of its opposition to the 2015 deal and diplomacy with Iran. It has been engaged in a not-so-covert campaign to derail the Vienna negotiations.
Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian stresses that what has caused a pause in the negotiations is Iran's economic and trade demands, and the most important remaining issue is the effective removal of economic sanctions. The top diplomat says the maximum pressure campaign launched by former U.S. President Donald Trump must end. He says the window of diplomacy is still open, adding that Americans know what they need to do.
U.S. President Joe Biden was a vociferous critic of Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in May 2018. During his presidential campaign, he pledged to work to rejoin the agreement. But has he done so? Iran's top diplomat says that has not been the case so far.
The fact that the United States, under the Biden administration, has failed to return to compliance with the agreement shows that the United States is not really interested in a rules-based international order, because one of the most basic pillars of international law by the United States' own agreement are United Nations Security Council resolutions. And again, it's binding.
Amir Abdollahian told the World Economic Forum that Biden's policy towards Iran has not been different from Trump's hostile approach. The Iranian foreign minister said the U.S. president must decide now whether he wants to waste time or courageously return to complying with U.S. commitments under the 2015 deal. His comments come after U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley said the prospects of a return to the Iran nuclear deal are tenuous at best. Malley made the remarks on the same day that the Biden administration unveiled new sanctions on Iran. The U.S. Special Envoy for Iran noted, however, that Washington still believes it is in the national security interests of the United States to try to salvage the 2015 agreement. The future of the hard-earned international deal remains unclear and could unravel completely if Washington fails to return to its commitments. Meanwhile, Israel is doing its utmost to prevent any deal between Washington and Iran, just as it did before the JCPOA came into existence in 2015.
No group and no block of people has more power and influence in the United States than Jewish leaders in shaping how Americans think and American attitudes. And that's not only true, but it's especially true with regard to Iran. The American media is overwhelmingly very hostile to Iran. And this is in keeping with what Jewish leaders and all those who support Israel really want.
Will the administration of Joe Biden be able to withstand pressure exerted by the Israeli lobby and act based on America's national interests?
China has hit back at a Thursday speech by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that called for action to counterbalance Beijing's influence. China has accused Blinken of smearing its domestic and foreign policies. China says Blinken's speech spreads false information and interferes in its internal affairs. Beijing says the speech shows that Washington seeks to suppress China's development and maintain its own hegemony and power. The top American diplomat accused China of posing the most serious long-term challenge to the international order. Blinken said that China wants to reshape the order and called on countries to prevent that. Ties between the two powers have become tense in the past 2 years, with both pointing the finger at each other's policies. And Russian forces have come closer to surrounding Ukrainian troops in two eastern cities as they try to expand their control over the Donbas region. The Russians have been attacking from three sides to encircle the Ukrainians in the cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk. That's according to Ukrainian officials. They say Russian forces reached the last highway out of the cities and even set up a checkpoint, but it was later broken. The officials say the Russian army does not control the route now, but they are shelling it. If those two cities fall, Russia would gain control over the Donbas province of Luhansk. Over the past few weeks, Russia has focused its fighting in the industrial eastern Donbas region, where Moscow-backed pro-independence fighters are stationed. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is pursuing a policy of genocide in Donbas. Well, Ukrainian far-right military regiment hit the headlines after Russia launched its military operation in the country. Our correspondent in Mariupol, Johnny Miller, tells us how the extremist group is engaged in the Ukrainian conflict.
The notorious Azov Battalion, officially part of Ukraine's National Guard. Their neo-Nazi roots are well documented, as are many of their crimes before the war started, such as the use of torture. Nazi-affiliated insignia remains a common sight on their clothing. Their base was in Mariupol, overlooking the Sea of Azov. They defended it fiercely against the Russians, but lost. Amongst the ruins, some anti-Azov graffiti. It reads, "Death to Fascism," and some more graffiti, perhaps written by an Azov member. It sums up their ideology. Life is slowly returning to the city, but people here will live with what they saw for the rest of their lives.
Yes, I witnessed Azov killing civilians. It was in Kurchatov Street. They were shooting from there, shelling blocks of flats, private houses, everywhere.
Each had three bazookas and a machine gun, and they started shooting. I can't say where they were shooting, because they locked us in the basement and warned if we attempted to leave, they would shoot us in the head. So we sat in the basement. The walls were shaking and they were firing with everything, with those American javelins as well.
Ask anyone in Mariupol who was here during the fighting and they will likely tell you stories like these, of Azov targeting civilian houses and of the use of hostages and human shields.
It's striking that everybody I've spoken to today here in Mariupol has no criticism of the Ukrainian army, who treated them well, gave them food, helped them evacuate, but that it's Azov, the Azov battalion, who mistreated them, using them as human shields and shooting them, targeting them.
The Ukrainian military have an aim to defend civilians, and they do it. But Azov ignore these rules, and they humiliate people in different ways. Once I saw them pull two women from the streets and drive off somewhere.
This is Konstantin Ivachenko, the new mayor of Mariupol.
We are finding traces of their crimes gradually. In the area of Mariupol airport, there are brutal places. There was a prison called the library, and all people who disagreed with the neo-Nazi point of view were tortured there.
Have you found any NATO weapons with Azov? Is there evidence that NATO has been arming Azov?
Yes, sure. We found stingers and javelins. After the city is reconstructed, we will put them on show. We have a lot of them. Lots of javelins.
While thousands of Azov members have either been killed or have surrendered in Mariupol, they remain a powerful influence in Ukraine, not least because unlike many Ukrainian soldiers, they are ideologically driven to fight the Russians. As NATO weapons flood the country, many of them will find their way into the hands of extremists. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
U.S. police are under scrutiny for their late response to a school shooting that killed 19 elementary students and two adults in the state of Texas on Tuesday. A video circulating online shows families of the students urging officers to take action while standing outside the school. Local media say police waited outside for at least 40 minutes before confronting the gunman. The shooting took place in the city of Uvalde. Earlier, authorities held a press briefing praising police for their quick response to the massacre. Families of the victims dismissed that. Meanwhile, activists have gathered outside the U.S. Capitol calling for action to control gun violence.
Action! Action! people to know we do this because we love our children.
Yes.
I'm here because I'm scared it's going to be me next. I don't know who's next. Me, my friends, my peers, and nothing's being changed. I'm a 17-year-old girl in high school, and something needs to be changed, and there needs to be laws in place.
I'm a grandma. I'm against guns. That's all. Gag. It makes me gag every time this happens, and it happens all the time.
Always.
2 times in the last 12 days.
It's our second go-round.
How much more can we put up with this stuff?
The activists called for more restrictions on people legally acquiring guns. Some also proposed prohibiting gun purchases by the people under 21. They argued that such a rule could have prevented the 18-year-old shooter in Texas from acquiring weapons. The U.S. has seen several mass shootings this month. Almost 2 weeks ago, a gunman opened fire at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. 10 people were killed and 3 wounded. 11 of the victims were African-American. The World Health Organization has urged countries to take quick action to contain the spread of monkeypox. A senior official with the UN agency says the priority needs to be containing the rare viral illness in non-endemic countries. Sylvia Bryan has told the agency's annual assembly, quote, "If we put the right measures in place now, we can contain it easily." The measures include the early detection and isolation of cases and contact tracing. Bryan has also called on the general public not to worry, since the transmission of the virus is much slower than others, such as the coronavirus. Monkeypox is endemic in parts of West and Central Africa, but it has spread to about 20 countries where nearly 300 confirmed or suspected cases have so far been reported. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Documents show that in 2021, arms made and funded by the United States of America destroyed UNRWA schools and USAID projects in Gaza. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Daniel Baxla, journalist. This article is titled, "Zionist Regime Used U.S. Weapons to Destroy Assets and Projects in Gaza." Here's the story. Last May, in an assault on the occupied Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime deployed hundreds of bombs, missiles, and shells, killing over 240 Palestinians and wounding more than 1,900 others. More than half of the dead were civilians. According to the Israeli think tank Meir Amit Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center, despite the Zionist regime's claims that it only targets combatants, at the end of the 11-day assault, tens of thousands of Gazans were displaced from damaged homes, already struggling in a region with a 50% unemployment rate, toxic water, and crumbling infrastructure. Thousands of housing units, hundreds of schools, and 19 healthcare facilities were also damaged. Compounding the devastating toll on Palestinian civilians, weapons made and funded by the United States were used to destroy American humanitarian projects and businesses, documents and reporting reviewed by The Intercept show. The destruction reached multiple hospitals and water treatment facilities supported by the U.S. Agency for International Development. Dozens of schools operated by the State Department-funded United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA, and a Coca-Cola plant built by a U.S. citizen. Raed Jarar, Advocacy Director at Democracy for the Arab World Now, or DAWN, told Intercept, "The vast majority of ammunition used by Israel is manufactured or subsidized by the United States of America." It's fair to say that every Israeli munition is subsidized by the U.S. one way or another by U.S. tax dollars. Impoverished in no small part thanks to a decade and a half long Israeli regime blockade, Gaza relies heavily on foreign aid to avert the worst humanitarian outcomes. The U.S. State Department had just renewed a lapsed funding commitment to the UNRWA, contributing $150 million to support more than 500,000 Palestinian visit schools and health care facilities. According to documents compiled from the United Nations, the Palestinian Authority, the human rights groups, more than 100 UNRWA facilities in Gaza were damaged in the 11-day bombing campaign in May 2021, requiring over $1 million in repairs. Dozens more schools administered by the Palestinian Authority suffered similar damage. It was hardly the first time that the U.S.-funded weapons had been used to destroy aid projects the different countries support. In 2014, during an earlier Israeli regime attack on Gaza, a Hellfire missile manufactured and paid for by the United States of America targeted an UNRWA school, killing 10 Palestinians. The massacre drew widespread condemnation, even eliciting a rare rebuke from different administrations who decried it as totally indefensible. What remained unspoken then was the fact that both the missile and the school was funded by the United States regime. The U.S. State Department was not the only federal agency whose funds supported aid projects that U.S. weaponry destroyed. Documents and news reviewed by Intercept show that more than a dozen factories in East Gaza's industrial zone built with funding from USAID, along with several USAID-funded projects for providing water, hygiene, and sanitation, were struck by U.S. weapons. In Khan Yunis, Rafah, and Beit Lahia, wastewater treatment infrastructure and water reservoir funded by aid, which the U.S. regime spent millions to construct, were destroyed by aerial attacks that affected more than 300,000 civilians, again by U.S. weapons. 97% of the water in Gaza is contaminated, resulting in a widespread public health crisis, rendered even worse by the destruction of U.S.-funded water infrastructure. A major reason for the perpetuation of the Israeli occupation and the deaths and suffering which accompany it
Is there extraordinary military, diplomatic, and political support given to it largely without conditions by the United States of America, said Michael Link, the recently departed UN Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories, adding, this American military assistance is provided notwithstanding the fact that congressional laws governing U.S. weapons exports state that recipient countries cannot be engaged in consistent patterns of gross human rights violations. While the fabricated regime of Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. military aid, it is subject to virtually no checks in operation, ensuring that U.S. weapons are not used to commit war crimes, destroy U.S.-funded projects, or damage the property of U.S. citizens in Gaza. Statutes that govern how aid to the Palestinian territories can be dispersed, however, are stringent. The audits ensuring that there are no ties between U.S. funding and different groups cost millions of dollars, sometimes exceeding the cost of the very aid projects being audited. Since 1948, the United States has provided the fake regime of Israel with over $150 billion in assistance, receiving in exchange a foothold in a region of massive strategic importance. The current model exists under a memorandum of understanding that Barack Obama signed in 2016, committing to $38 billion in aid between 2019 and 2028, with an open-door policy for additional aid, like the $1 billion Congress gave the Zionist regime in March for its Iron Dome missile system. The aid system also provides cash flow financing, a system resembling layaway that allows the Israeli regime to purchase weapons in the present using money from the future. And it contains an offshore procurement exemption offered to no other regime that allows the Zionist regime to spend U.S. tax dollars on its own weapons industry without disclosing how it spent the money to Congress or the American public. And of course, the United States maintains its own stockpiled weapons in the occupied territories available for use by Israeli forces, despite the Zionist regime's status as one of the largest arms exporters in the world. In two instances, the Zionist regime tapped into the U.S. stockpile to wage campaigns against the Palestinian groups. The end result is an Israeli arsenal almost entirely composed of weapons made or subsidized by the U.S. regime. While mechanisms for punishing war crimes perpetrated by the Zionist regime with the U.S. support are selectively enforced against many other countries, the lack of scrutiny over the Israeli forces' use of American weapons is glaring. Amid last May's onslaught, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace detailed the number of U.S. laws violated by the Zionist regime's attacks. These included the Foreign Assistance Act, which stipulates that aid cannot be provided to a country which engages in a consistent pattern of gross violations of internationally recognized human rights. The Arms Export Control Act, which bans U.S. military assistance to countries using weapons for reasons other than legitimate self-defense, and the Lee Laws, named for outgoing U.S. Senator Patrick Lee, which ban weapon sales to military units that have committed a gross violation of human rights.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist. can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
U.S. inflation is at a 40-year high. The country's national debt has topped $30 trillion for the first time as borrowing surged amid the pandemic. With debt at an all-time high, military spending has not been reduced but increased, demonstrating the utter disregard of politicians for the economic effects it has on ordinary Americans. The U.S. controls about 750 military bases in more than 80 countries worldwide, meddling in other countries' affairs, while the cost of food, housing, gasoline, utilities, and other goods rose by 7.5% over the past year. Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we'll discuss rising costs in the United States. Why has inflation risen so much? What is the meaning of an increase in the country's national debt? Can the United States still afford to keep its 750 military bases abroad? Who is paying the price for the astronomical expenditure on the military and who is gaining from it? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our program, Todd Boyle, retired CPA and anti-war activist from Oregon, and Ibra Tahir, Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate 2022, also from Oregon. $30 trillion. That's the milestone the U.S. national debt has surpassed this year. The debt is so large that the government has to spend more than the country's entire annual economy to be able to pay it off.
According to the U.S. Treasury Department's recent data, the U.S. national debt has surpassed $30 trillion U.S. dollars for the first time. It is $7 trillion higher than last year's U.S. GDP, which was about $23 trillion. It is greater than the combined GDP of China, Japan, and Germany, and is equivalent to 26 times the combined GDP of the world's 46 least developed countries. To divide it by the total U.S. population of 330 million, each American is burdened with over $90,000 of federal government debt. If the legal tax age is taken into account, each American taxpayer is burdened with nearly $240,000 of debt. In early 1980s, the United States became the world's largest debtor country and has remained so till this day. In recent years, its debt has been growing at an accelerated pace. In the 5 years from 2017 to the present, it increased by nearly $10 trillion. Now, in every 4 seconds, the U.S. federal government debt increased by nearly $100,000. Especially since the outbreak of the COVID-19 pandemic, in just 2 years, the debt has increased by nearly $7 trillion.
The fact is that inflation is a systemic process that's been going on for many years, mostly at much slower paces, except for 1973, 72, 73, 74. You know, I was alive at that time, and the savings of most retired people at that time was mostly in fixed income certificates of deposit and other fixed income interest-bearing things. And the value of those assets was cut in half. So they literally lost half of their life savings, retired people did, in 72 to 74. And then we had another round of inflation in 79, 80. So inflation is very bad. It's bad for people who are savers, but it's also bad for workers. Workers' wages never keep up with the pace of their costs. Their rent goes up and their food goes up and their gas prices go up faster than their wages go up.
Inflation is at a 40-year high. The price of living has gone up and it's hurting everyone. But low-income families and individuals are definitely hit the hardest.
When I used to go to the grocery store, I wasn't as conscious about prices. Like, I would just, if I needed a bag of spinach, I would just grab a bag without really looking at the price as much. And now I'm doing more, like, cost comparison between different brands. So just a little bit more aware when I'm in the store.
I got a truck. So, you know, the gas prices is really high for me. So some days I have to, like, borrow money to get to work.
Gas prices are going up extremely. And I'd be so glad when they come down. You know, due to the COVID, people don't have money. We just starting back to work and stuff like that. This is outrageous, the prices of the gas today.
There has been some wage increases, but it's by no means able to counter the inflation rate. Some economists blame supply chain disruptions due to the COVID-19 pandemic for the surge in inflation.
Well, unfortunately, so the U.S. government decided to destroy the economy of the working class. But in return, there was nothing except for debt, inflation. I'm not advocating for the welfare state at all. This is not my position. But this is the consequences of the COVID-19 policies that were put in place. Now, what we are seeing is after the third stimulus check, there is something we have in the country, which is the unemployment insurance. It continued for a while, but now it was ended. But this was only the help that the communities got from the policies of COVID-19.
And now, whether or not that is accurate, prices of almost everything has gone up, and it is making living harder and harder for Americans. So why has inflation gone up so much?
The official story is the cost went up because of supply chain disruptions. So this included, shutdown of a lot of production in China, and it included the disruption of an overloading of the ports, which was in turn, that was caused partly by consumers buying a lot of durable goods, anticipating inflation, right? So what caused costs to go up for business is a lot of their key inputs went up in cost and became unavailable. And what caused costs to go up for individuals was retail prices. Retail costs are up 7% now, I think I read, for the year. I mean, year on year in January and February.
Now, Republicans are using the rise in costs and inflation to slam the Biden administration. According to a poll released by the Quinnipiac University, in January, 54% of Americans think the U.S. economy is getting worse, and only 15% think it's actually getting better. Poll also stated 57% of Americans do not approve of Joe Biden's handling of the U.S. economy. Is the economy now expected to get worse?
Well, the current hyperinflation, what we call the hyperinflation, is caused mainly by the 2020 spending, which is the spending that happened during the COVID-19. The U.S. government has spent $8 trillion that it didn't have, which means that it needed to borrow money. And the government, when it needs to borrow money, goes to the Federal Reserve and asks them to print money that nobody has. It's not backed by gold. It is a fiat currency that is the main cause for the inflation. Actually, it is the cause of the inflation. So when we talk about 40-year high, we're actually expecting to see more inflation, more devaluation of the currency. And this is the policy that set forward by Woodrow Wilson in 1930 when they acted the Federal Reserve Act. So this is a direct consequence of that bill, of that policy that is controlled by private bankers in the country, which is not constitutional.
The amount of money Americans have spent on their government's ambitious and ridiculously interventionist foreign policy, with different excuses like spreading democracy and defeating terrorism, has reduced the domestic resources so much that the people feel the pinch. The United States spends more on national security than the next 6 or 7 countries combined. This extravagant expenditure comes when the country is having inflation problems and very serious issues with infrastructure and climate change.
Military spending hasn't grown exponentially. It has grown incrementally for many years, actually. I mean, the problem was that it never was reduced after the collapse of the USSR, which was the main justification for the Cold War. But the military spending is not even in the top 10 industries in the United States. Military spending runs around $1 trillion a year, if they were honest, including veterans costs and other direct costs. And there's at least 10 other sectors of the economy that are larger. So, for example, education spending in the U.S. is $7 trillion or something. It's just huge. There's 10 times the number of headcount as there are in the military. And so we have retail and all these other big activities in the U.S. that are actually larger than the military. The trouble with the military is it doesn't produce anything, any goods or services for anybody. And so it's just money down a rat hole, and the entire military sector is dead weight on the economy.
Now, according to the Institute for Economics and Peace, there is a belief, or should we say myth, that war and military spending has had positive economic outcomes for the U.S. economy. A poll conducted by CNN in 2008 found more than a quarter of respondents believe that spending in Iraq had no impact on America's economic position. Despite this position, the study reiterates that there has been a number of negative economic effects from conducting U.S. wars.
The military spending is taking a huge chunk of the people's economy. We're talking about 56% of our tax dollars go directly to the Pentagon. That's a huge amount of money. So when we talk about the spending, actually, we're not talking about spending tax dollars because we don't have it. We're already in 30 trillions in debt. We're talking about borrowing money, printing money, and raising the inflation. This is what we're talking about. This is how we cover our expenses, including the military. The U.S. government has no limits in spending because it has the Federal Reserve System, which can print money out of nothing.
The study adds that it could be said that if the wars had not happened, taxes would have been lower, inflation would have been lower, there would have been higher consumption and investment, and definitely lower budget deficits. Overall, the well-being of people would have been more positive. There would have been more money to spend on poor communities and more budget for education and health care.
The military sector is not beneficial to anybody except the welfare recipients themselves, you know, the workers on the base, the military themselves. There's several million people who get directly paid by the military complex. And so it benefits them the way that welfare benefits, you know, welfare recipients. Or I get Social Security, I'm retired, so that benefits me, but it doesn't benefit society.
Another study published in the Defense and Peace Economics Journal in 2018 showed when military spending increases by just 1%, spending on health decreases by 0.62% around the world. This becomes more important at a time where the pandemic is still surging in America and money could be spent on people's lives and health is being spent on the military. So who benefits from the U.S. military?
Well, there are two aspects of that. One of them, when we talk about the military, actually what is happening with our military is opening markets worldwide. This is one of the reasons. Actually, probably one of the main reasons that we have military everywhere is to control the markets. And when we control the markets, it means it is very beneficial to the economy. So partially, it is beneficial to the economy because it creates jobs. Those weapons manufacturers actually create jobs that we don't need and ethically must be refuted. But this is the reality, unfortunately, in our country. On the other hand, when you talk about the spending that goes to the military, when in the relation with the Federal Reserve and the spending, so we are devaluing also the dollar. So the benefit can go to only a specific segment of the society.
Now, according to the Pew Research poll in 2011, only 8% of Americans believe that there are other countries that are better than America. That has risen to 21% in 2019 and is 46% among 18 to 29-year-olds and 47% for young voters on the left. Now, this attitude of feeling superior to other nations and people around the world has been one of the reasons why the U.S. could sell its war excuses and extreme spending on the military to its people.
It's true that the World War II coincided with the end of the Great Depression because we went into a command economy where you command, you know, half the workers to go and build weapons. So if they want to argue for a command economy, you know, China is a great example. It could benefit the people a lot, but actually it doesn't. You know, this is a myth. So you know who it does benefit and where a lot of the propaganda narrative comes from is from the communities around the military bases. We're like Lakewood, Washington, where half the population either works on the bases or is, you know, a retailer like a barbershop owner or something whose sales depends on the base. So no public figure ever really stands up and says, you know, the military is important for our economy.
Now the United States has about 750 bases in at least 80 countries around the world. According to global U.S. military deployment data published in the Conflict Management and Peace Science Journal, the U.S. had around 173,000 troops deployed in 159 countries as of 2020. With 120 active bases, Japan contains the largest number of U.S. bases in the world, followed by Germany with 119 and South Korea with 73. The government spends billions of dollars to maintain these bases and troops every year.
Less well known is the fact that the U.S. has around 800 military bases around the globe. This map can't even show that many dots. These are just 200 or so dots to give you an idea of where these bases are clustered. These bases are everything from massive military compounds to small airstrips in the middle of the ocean. If you combine all the foreign bases that every other nation has outside of its own borders, you get a total of about 30. There's never been a country with such a massive global presence. And the big question is, how did these bases get there in the first place? And how much is it costing U.S. taxpayers to keep them open?
Now, most politicians have completely turned a blind eye to public opposition towards war, military presence abroad, and the ever-growing cost of the military. They ignore it because they benefit from it. Military lobbyists are very strong, and they are large campaign donors. Politicians, they do not care how this overspending has resulted in hardships of many Americans, especially the poor and underprivileged, how it has risen the national debt and also contributed to inflation.
Well, unfortunately, our government is not representing us, the people in the U.S., so they don't really worry about the national debt. They care about advancing policies. And our politicians in general, we call them self-serving politicians or servants of special interest groups. So they are in that position of power not to serve the people. This is why they don't care about actually any debt, how to cut our spending, how to really benefit the people instead of corporations and the upper class that we have. So this is basically a big reality in our country, unfortunately.
The U.S. government doesn't just owe over $30 trillion. It owes every single family it has killed while invading their country. It owes all the poor people who have lost their homes and their hopes were shattered because of U.S. bombing and attacks. It owes its own people for pushing the poor further into poverty. It is yet to be seen what the U.S. government is going to do when the people of the world gather to collect their debt.
And now let's check in with our guy in the States, Abbas Montaghim, to see what he has to share with us.
Today on Power to the People, we will examine capitalism and why inflation is always a part of the capitalist system. Capitalism is when a few people own and control all the means of production in a society. This means that in reality, there's only a few capitalists, and everyone else who doesn't own the means of production is subjected to capitalist exploitation. This is because everyone works for the capitalist, as the capitalist owns the product that's produced, as well as the company that produces the product. We then sell our labor to the capitalists for a wage or for a salary. And this has created a world where eight men, six of whom are American, control half the wealth on the earth. It's a system where the corporations and their politician lackeys, they control the market and the prices of the goods that we consume every single day. And a natural part of capitalism is inflation. Inflation is when the price of goods rises within the macro level of the economy. It's when whoever is selling the goods decides to increase the price on the good, which then sends a chain reaction throughout the whole economy. Those who control the means of production, aka the capitalists, they control this entire phenomenon. An example of macro level goods that affect the economy is oil. Oil produces multiple different products, and corporations set the price of its worth, and then this affects the price on everything which oil is used to produce. And this creates a ripple effect throughout the whole economy. We don't go buy oil from the source. We go to a corporate-owned gas station and buy gas for the price that these gas corporations and that the oil industry decides on what the price should be. These are all arbitrary numbers that these capitals make up so that they can make mass profits. If we look at the Rockefeller family, one of the richest families in the world, they sit in their house, they sit in their office, and they don't do anything to physically get the oil, yet they make billions in profit. And part of inflation in America is these corporations deliberately crashing the economy. The capitalists buy stock when it's low and sells the stocks when the market is high. Then they crash the market, and then they buy stocks when the market crashes, and this price of stock is once again cheap. They repeat this process over and over and over again and make massive profits. That is why it's not a matter of if the stock market will crash, it's a matter of when. And all of this affects the prices of everyday products and creates inflation. We also saw inflation happen through price gouging, which has been happening throughout this COVID-19 pandemic. As this virus infected people, there arose a need for masks, tests, medical equipment, and other goods. Those who make the masks and produce the equipment, oftentimes they decide to raise the price in order to make a higher profit. We saw countless examples of stores on Amazon selling COVID masks and tests at insane prices, when in reality, masks and tests should be given out for free to everyone because it's a public good. But that does not happen under capitalism, as profit drives everything under the capitalist system. Politicians, aka the ruling class, they also take advantage of this. Politicians, they knew the severity of the COVID-19 pandemic long before the general public did. And a minimum of 75 lawmakers, they invested their money in companies that had played a major role in the response to COVID-19. This allowed for politicians to get rich off of having insider knowledge and corporations to get rich because of the increased purchasing of stocks and the market rising. These politicians were worried about their own pocketbooks while stay-at-home orders were on the way and when the masses of people were about to deal with massive job loss and increased poverty. NFL lineman Tyler Crosby, he asked an important question. If as an NFL player we aren't allowed to bet on games, why are government officials allowed to buy stocks and stock options? This exposes the system for what it is. This whole market is rigged for the corporations and politicians. You can't pick yourself up by the bootstraps in a system that is controlled for them to win. The corporations and its politicians, they decide the prices of the market. We have no decision-making power in it. And this is the part of exploitation by capitalism. When the system isn't controlled by the people and it's instead controlled by the capitalists, corporations can do whatever they want, when they want. They exploit the masses of people, no matter what the crisis is, whether it's a recovery from a natural disaster or a virus like COVID-19. If we want to put an end to inflation, we have to put an end to imperialist capitalism. Capitalism is why inflation happens, and we must understand this. This is Power to the People.
I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and make sure to tune in next time when we return with another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.